Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is something we're calling a forensic investment interrogation.
That's a great way to put it.
We are not just analyzing a company. We're putting one of the most iconic, yet I think paradoxically discounted, industrial brands under the microscope. Snap-on Incorporated, ticker SNA.
And look, for the experienced critical investor, this deep dive is absolutely essential. And it's because Snap-on presents what I'd call the classic industrial paradox.
Okay, what's that?
It's the tension that really creates the alpha opportunity. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you have this, you know, aristocratic compounder.
A century-old business model.
Exactly. It's existed for a century. It has an iconic brand that commands pricing power, almost like a luxury good. And it has this undeniable structural track record of generating return on invested capital, ROIC, that just fundamentally crushes its cost of capital.
Right.
That pedigree, that ability to generate economic value that defines a high-quality moat.
Absolutely. And that's the bull case in a nutshell right there.
Yeah.
But then you have to look across the fence and see the structural risks that feed this other narrative, the legacy value trap narrative.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hardware manufacturer still, you know, tethered to the internal combustion engine, the ICE.
Mm-hmm.
And critically, it's reliant on an antiquated mobile franchise distribution model,
mm-hmm.
the tool truck. It feels wildly out of step with the, I don't know, the velocity of the 21st century.
It does. It feels like a relic. So our goal today, it has to move beyond simply, you know, internalizing what management says on the earnings calls.
All that talk about coherent growth.
Coherent growth, rapid continuous improvement. We need a comprehensive, skeptical, and forensic analysis to really determine the fundamental durability and, I think most importantly, the terminal value of this enterprise.
Yeah.
We have to move past the comforting nostalgia of the brand and look directly at the structural friction points that are punishing the valuation.
And those friction points, they're not really internal, are they? They're being driven by these three massive secular forces that are creating this persistent discount. Let's just lay them out clearly.
Good idea.
Because they really inform every single part of the business. First, you've got technological displacement. This is driven primarily by the global push toward electrification, the transition to electric vehicles or EVs.
Fewer moving parts. It's that simple.
It fundamentally changes what tools you need.
Deccan is channel disintermediation. The internet, you know, it has structurally eroded the logistical exclusivity that the mobile van channel once had.
It was a monopoly on access, in a way.
It was. And now every competitor, from the highest-end specialty guys to the low-cost Chinese importers, they can just bypass the truck. They can push product through e-commerce, through big-box retail. The distribution advantage isn't dead, but it is certainly wounded.
Okay, and the third one, the democratization of professional-grade manufacturing.
I like that framing.
This is what we might call the Milwaukee Tool and Harbor Freight effect. It's a scale effect. They are aggressively challenging Snap-on's historical price premium by leveraging consumer scale to offer, frankly, superior performance per dollar.
Especially in power tools.
Especially in the high-volume, high-frequency cordless power tool space. Snap-on is facing a technology price war that's supported by just massive industrial scale.
So when you combine those three threats, the tech, the channel, and the competition, the market is currently pricing Snap-on for stagnation. Not for robust growth, let alone its potential.
You see it right in the numbers.
You do. It trades at a noticeable PE discount to its high-quality peers, Illinois Tool Works being the big one. Therefore, the alpha generation here, for you, the critical investor, it depends entirely on one question.
And what's that?
Can the repair systems and information segment, the intelligent diagnostics arm, can it successfully transition the business model to one centered around data and recurring revenue and justify a multiple re-rating? That's the mission today.
Can data overcome steel in the eyes of the market?
That's it.
Okay, let's unpack this business architecture, because calling Snap-on just a tool company is, I don't know, it's like calling early Amazon just a bookstore.
Or IBM, a typewriter manufacturer. It's misleadingly simple, and it completely obscures the real sources of both profit and risk.
So break it down for us. What is it, really?
It's a vertically integrated conglomerate. And its unique 4-in-1 structure is both the moat itself and its biggest source of analytical complexity. For this dive, you have to understand it as 4 distinct entities operating at once.
Okay.
It is, of course, a high-end manufacturer. That's number one. It is also a specialty retailer through that franchise network.
Oh, trucks.
The trucks. But crucially, number 3, it's a sophisticated software developer and data service provider. That's its diagnostic tools, the Mitchell 1 data platforms. Hmm. And finally, number 4, it is a hugely powerful captive finance company, Snap-on Credit, or SOC.
Wow. So that vertical integration, it creates this complex, maybe fragmented, but extremely deep barrier to entry. But the foundation, the thing everyone thinks of, has always been the distribution barrier, the mobile van channel.
The Snap-on Tools Group, or SOT, as they call it.
Right.
And that mobile channel is, historically, Snap-on's single greatest strategic asset. It solves the last mile problem in a way that remains incredibly difficult for any competitor to replicate at scale.
I mean, what kind of scale are we even talking about?
We're talking about approximately 4,700 active routes globally, with about 3,400 of those operating right here in the U.S. alone. The truck shows up, you know, once a week, offers immediate, no questions asked warranty service, and it fosters this deep generational loyalty. It's cultural within the auto repair industry.
You know, when we talk about that loyalty, we're talking about the franchise owners showing up, knowing the mechanics' names, knowing their career path, basically underwriting their ambitions. I saw a note in one of the mechanic forums, a seasoned tech said, if the van doesn't pull up, it feels like a holiday's been canceled.
That's powerful.
That relationship is what Snap-on is selling now. Far more than just the physical steel.
And this brings us right to the point, why the value proposition is absolutely shifting and where that moat shows its first real signs of erosion. Historically, the truck offered access and logistical exclusivity.
You couldn't get it anywhere else.
You just couldn't. Not easily. Not with that warranty.
Yeah.
Today, a mechanic can pull out a smartphone while literally standing next to the van, compare specs, compare prices instantly, and probably have a comparable tool delivered by the next morning.
So, okay, the value proposition is no longer primarily access. It's decisively shifted. It's shifted to credit and that personal relationship.
That's it. The franchisee is a microlender. They are underwriting short-term risk based on knowing that mechanic's job security, their weekly income, their history.
And that trust, that personal relationship, it facilitates these immediate purchases of high-ticket items, right?
Yeah.
A $500 wrench set, the $3,000 diagnostics tablet.
All on a simple revolving credit account. It solves the professional mechanic's immediate liquidity crunch. They need the tool now to do the job. And the truck provides it.
So if that's the case, we need to do that forensic audit you mentioned on the health of this franchise system, because this feels like the single biggest black box risk for an investor trying to value this thing.
It is. Management constantly touts network stability. But if you look past the curated narratives on the earnings calls, there are some undeniable structural vulnerabilities in the profitability of the average route.
And the critical distinction here, I think, for a sophisticated audience is you have to separate turnover from churn.
Yes. Explain that.
Well, management will often report very low overall closure rates, which is true. But the franchise disclosure documents, they reveal this continuous expensive cycle of churn where routes are actively reacquired by the corporate entity itself.
Hundreds of them, right.
Estimates suggest hundreds of franchises are reacquired every single year.
And the economic implication of that process is just crucial. When an independent franchisee fails, corporate steps in. They often take over the inventory, they run it as a company-owned store for a while, and then they try to find a replacement operator.
So that process effectively scrubs the failure from the external statistics. It masks the true underlying attrition rate.
It hides the marginal unit economics that are causing the problem in the first place.
So that continuous need for corporate to step in and run the rounds, that signals a significant structural weakness in the core P&L of the independent operator.
Absolutely. The fact that corporate is forced to hold, what is it, about 5% of all routes as company-owned stores at the end of 2024?
Yeah, around that.
That tells you this franchise model is simply not self-sustaining in all territories. The cost of running those marginal routes is being subsidized by the corporate entity, taking a hit to the corporate P&L, just to maintain that critical channel presence and avoid abandoning the market.
So, okay, that weakness then forces us to immediately look at the true financial stabilizer of this whole system.
The company's captive bank.
Snap-on Credit, or SOC.
This is truly the hidden engine. And its disproportionate power is both a boon and a risk. SOC generates a staggering 20 to 25% of the company's total operating income.
20 to 25%.
But it only accounts for about 6% of total revenue. That is an extraordinary level of profitability leverage for a financial services arm inside an industrial company.
Okay, so as a critical investor, the skeptical question has to be asked immediately. Is Snap-on using this incredibly profitable financial arm to finance subprime borrowers? Are they just inflating tool sales by using cheap credit to move inventory the market might not otherwise absorb at these premium prices?
That is exactly the right question to ask. And the data, fortunately, suggests that management maintains a pretty high level of underwriting discipline.
How can we know that?
Well, the loans are secured by collateral, the tools themselves, which are professional grade, and importantly, they retain significant resale value. That mitigates the worst of that subprime risk. Furthermore, the 60-day delinquency rates have remained remarkably stable. They're at a manageable 2.0% as of the third quarter of 2025. This stability suggests they aren't just, you know, drastically lowering standards to juice sales.
Hold on a second. You just praised management's discipline, and the delinquency rate is stable. So if the underwriting is sound, why should we worry about this warning sign you flagged? A 4.8% decline in originations reported in Q3 2025.
Fair question.
Isn't that just management being cautious, rather than a genuine warning sign of technician hesitation?
It's a fair challenge. The discipline is definitely evident in the stable delinquency rates. The warning sign, though, lies in the type of purchases that are being deferred.
Okay, so what's being deferred?
These high-ticket purchases are typically the non-essential but very high-status items. The large tool storage units, the heavy-duty rolling cabinets that can cost anywhere from $5,000 up to $30,000.
The big red toolboxes.
The big red toolboxes. These are purchases that reflect a mechanic's confidence in their long-term job stability and their income trajectory.
I see. So the 4.8% decline in originations isn't a credit risk problem. It's a direct pulse reading on the professional mechanic's confidence and sentiment.
Exactly.
If they're pulling back on financing these large, high-status capital goods, it reflects broader economic uncertainty. Or maybe a structural shift in how much debt they're willing to take on for status items.
And that will put immediate pressure on the core tools group revenue. That hesitation in originations is a leading indicator. If technicians are deferring the purchase of a $10,000 toolbox for 6 months, the top line growth for the core tool business, the Snap-on Tools Group, is going to feel that pressure quickly, regardless of how good the credit portfolio looks.
Okay, let's shift now and dissect the economics of the three core operating segments. Let's interrogate where future growth is supposed to come from. So overall, we're looking at SOT, the Snap-on Tools Group, at about 37% of total revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the segment that really drives the bull case, Repair Systems and Information, or RS&I, at 31%. And finally, the Diversification Hedge, Commercial and Industrial, C&I, at 26%.
Starting with the Snap-on Tools Group, SOT, this is undeniably the threatened legacy. SOT is the most exposed to that commoditization threat we talked about, particularly in power tools.
That's where the competition is just brutal.
It is, largely because the battery standardization movement has made performance metrics almost fungible.
But it's crucial to remember that the core legacy hand tools, the wrenches, the ratchets, the torque bars, they remain a fortress of profitability.
Hey, absolutely.
The brand heritage, the lifetime warranty that's honored right there on the truck, the expectation of metallurgy and performance, all of these factors mean they still command a remarkably high gross margin.
That pricing power is sticky in the physical tool space. Why? Because the economic cost of a broken wrench, a busted bolt, a missed service window is so, so high.
But where that stickiness just fundamentally breaks down is in the cordless power tool arena. And here, the Milwaukee threat from Tektronix Industries, or TTI, is not just undeniable. It's an operational masterclass in disruption.
It really is. TTI fundamentally altered the competitive landscape. They leveraged massive consumer channel scale selling through, you know, places like Home Depot, and they aggressively funded R&D to develop the standardized modular M12 and M18 battery platforms.
And what that means functionally is that Milwaukee and its industrial counterpart, Makita, can offer superior performance per dollar compared to Snap-on's proprietary cordless systems.
Their scale lets them amortize R&D and battery costs across a much larger volume. It just creates a pricing disadvantage for Snap-on.
And this ties directly into a critical demographic risk that we've seen bubble up in mechanic forums.
The generational divide, it's stark. Older techs, they're heavily invested in the Snap-on ecosystem. They're psychologically tied to the truck, and they stay loyal.
But the younger apprentices?
The critical future customer base.
Exactly. They're increasingly viewing Snap-on cordless tools as overpriced, proprietary, and frankly, technologically inferior compared to the latest lithium-ion offerings from the competition.
And if Snap-on loses that entry-level customer, the person who buys their first mid-range drill, that demographic risk will cascade through the entire sales pipeline for the next two decades as the older generation retires.
Okay, so let's pivot hard to the segment that bulls hang their hats on, the Repair Systems and Information segment, RS&I. This is the segment that accounts for nearly a third of revenue, and critically, it's the primary growth engine. It's the entire justification for a potential valuation re-rating into a higher multiple data company.
And RS&I benefits immensely from the macro trend of increasing vehicle complexity. I mean, modern vehicles are mobile computers. They generate petabytes of proprietary data.
So what was Snap-on's strategic masterstroke here?
The transition to what they call intelligent diagnostics. They're moving away from merely selling a piece of hardware, a dedicated disposable scanner, to selling a high-margin, recurring revenue productivity solution.
Right. So by acquiring and integrating key platforms like Mitchell 1, they create this incredibly sticky software subscription mode.
Exactly. They integrate the repair information directly into the diagnostic workflow. A mechanic plugs in the scanner, it reads the fault code, and immediately pulls up the exact OEM procedure, the parts diagram, the repair time estimate required.
So you're no longer buying a tool. You're buying productivity, compliance, and guaranteed uptime.
And we saw the tangible results in the third quarter of 2025. RS&I delivered a very strong 8.9% organic sales growth. It's significantly outpacing the single-digit performance of the legacy tool business.
So that's the hard, quantitative evidence that the market should eventually value Snap-on's data and software services more highly than its physical steel tools.
The growth engine is structurally sound, provided the moat holds.
Ah, but that moat is not impermeable. This segment faces intense competitive pressure, primarily from aggressive Chinese competitors.
Wattel and LaunchTech.
Right. These companies offer diagnostic tablets that perform similar core functional-level diagnostics at, what, 30 to 40% of the cost of a Snap-on unit?
That's right. And this forces Snap-on to rely on higher-end features and proprietary data access. So their defense rests on two foundational pillars. First, it's intellectual property and patent protection, which is a continuous battle we've seen in the courts with various lawsuits about data scraping.
And the second pillar.
Its ability to integrate specific OEM proprietary data. This is essential for complex warranty-level repairs that require deep access to vehicle modules. But as those IP barriers fall and reverse engineering gets more sophisticated, maintaining that data moat will be a continuous, expensive strategic battle. It requires constant investment.
Okay, finally, let's give due attention to the commercial and industrial, or C&I, segment. This acts as the crucial diversification hedge, accounting for 26% of total revenue.
And this is a fundamentally different customer dynamic. C&I target sectors where price sensitivity is almost non-existent because reliability is absolutely mandatory. Aerospace, military, mining, natural resources.
In these critical industries, the cost of tool failure is catastrophic.
Absolutely. Think about aviation maintenance protocols. A broken bolt on a jet engine, an incorrect torque setting on a critical assembly, that could result in millions of dollars in downtime, or worse, huge safety risks. The purchasing manager is optimizing for certified reliability and long-term compliance, not price.
So this strategic focus provides crucial insulation from the cyclical consumer auto repair cycle that really plagues the SOT segment. And the acquisition of Mounts in 2023 for $40 million reinforces this strategy perfectly, doesn't it?
Beautifully. Mounts specializes in advanced high-precision torque capabilities and calibration equipment.
And this ties C&I directly into the high-margin, high-tolerance manufacturing of the future, specifically EV assembly.
That's the link. EV battery packs require thousands of specialized fasteners and seals that must be torqued to incredibly precise specifications. You have to ensure structural integrity and prevent thermal runaway. Mounts provides the calibrated tools and the data logging required for that high-tolerance assembly, which guarantees Snap-on a role in the next generation of industrial manufacturing, regardless of the IC decline.
It's a slow, steady, and very high-margin business.
Precisely.
So the financial profile of Snap-on, it really reveals this core operational paradox that defines the whole investment debate. You've got relative revenue stagnation contrasted sharply with an extraordinary margin expansion triumph.
That is the essence of why the stock is valued as it is. If you track the financial history, the nominal revenue growth between, say, 2016 and 2024 was about 3% CAGR.
3%.
And when you adjust for inflation over that entire period, the real volume growth is basically negligible. That is the fundamental quantitative support for the bear case. This is a market saturation story. Snap-on is maintaining share in a mature market but struggling to expand its total addressable market volume.
But the operating income story? It exists in a completely different galaxy. This is where management's operational discipline just shines through, and it's often overlooked by people who are just focused on the top line.
Their operational control program, called Rapid Continuous Improvement, or RCI, has structurally reset the company's profitability floor.
The numbers are pretty unambiguous, aren't they?
They are. Operating margin, and this is before you even account for the lucrative financial services segment, it expanded from around 19% in 2016 to 23.4% in Q3 2025. That's a 400-plus basis point expansion in a low-growth, challenging macro environment.
That's hard evidence of profound operational leverage.
And RCI, to give context, it involves specific, often kind of mundane manufacturing efficiencies, standardized global factory layouts, reductions in SKU complexity, aggressive waste reduction. Management often quantifies this not just in margin percentage, but in reduced inventory lead times and save hours of labor per tool produced.
And the structural persistence of that margin expansion, it confirms a powerful component of the bull case, robust pricing power.
Which is confirmed by their gross margins. They remain consistently above 50%, even when facing unprecedented post-pandemic supply chain disruptions and input inflation. They didn't have to absorb those costs.
And this passed them right through to the end customer.
That's the ultimate indicator of a resilient brand and a true moat. Customers, whether it's the individual mechanic or a procurement manager in an industrial shop, they accept the price increases because, as we've said, the economic cost of not having a Snap-on tool is perceived as far higher than the price premium they pay.
So the RCI program just ensures those price increases flow straight to the bottom line.
Structurally funding the dividend increases and the M&A.
Okay, let's talk about the metric that truly separates the high-quality compounders from just average industrials. Return on invested capital, ROIC, versus the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC.
This is the ultimate arbiter of management efficacy. And Snap-on consistently generates ROIC in the range of 17% to 22%.
17 to 22%.
And when you compare that to an estimated WACC of roughly 8.86%, you see that the company generates immense economic value added, or EVA, year after year. Every dollar of capital invested is generating more than double the required return. This is not a capital gobbling business. It's a capital efficient cash machine.
And that high ROIC isn't an accident. It's structural. The franchise model makes Snap-on incredibly asset light at the corporate level.
That's the key.
Inventory and receivables are mostly carried either by the independent franchisee or they're held within Snap-on Credit, which, as we established, is itself a high profit center.
Correct. Their manufacturing base is incredibly efficient, a result of decades of that RCI work. Annual maintenance CapEx is typically only about $100 million, which is a tiny fraction, only about 2% of sales. This combination results in massive free cash flow generation.
Which then directs the conversation straight to capital allocation.
Right. What do they do with all that cash?
But before we get there, let's apply a metric often reserved for the software age, the Rule of 40, to explain why the market applies this industrial valuation discount, despite the high ROIC.
Yeah, that's a great lens. The Rule of 40 is a simple heuristic. Your growth rate plus your operating margin should equal 40% or more for an elite high-growth company.
And Snap-on.
It falls short, but understandably so. With nominal revenue growth languishing at, 0 to 3% and margins at a superb 25%, Snap-on scores a 25 to 28.
Not 40.
Not 40. The market is essentially saying, we love your quality, we love your margins, but you cannot deliver the volume growth or the top line velocity required to justify an elite growth multiple. This numerical deficit fundamentally explains the market's skepticism.
Okay, so given all this consistent free cash flow and operational discipline, how does management allocate capital? The word that comes to mind for me is prudence. But for a critical investor focused on maximizing returns, the action might verge on paralysis.
I think that's a fair criticism. We have to start with the dividend anchor. The dividend has sacred cow status within the company's culture. They have paid consecutive quarterly cash dividends since 1939.
Wow.
And crucially for investor portfolios, they've increased that dividend for 15 consecutive years. The most recent hike in November 2024 was a robust 15.1% increase, taking it to $2.14 per share.
Now, with a low payout ratio of about 45%, that dividend is incredibly safe.
Sustainable, and designed perfectly for income-focused investors looking for inflation protection.
But the execution of share buybacks, that tells a very different story. It tells a story of reluctance about maximizing shareholder returns through financial engineering.
You're right. Despite a fortress balance sheet, and remember, that's $1.53 billion in cash against only $1.2 billion in long-term debt, and a stock price often trading below what seems to be its intrinsic value, Snap-on has been remarkably conservative.
They really have. The share count has only marginally declined over the last decade. It's barely moved the needle on EPS growth. In 2024, they repurchased only 952,000 shares.
Which is nothing, given their vast, predictable free cash flow and the stock consistently trading at a discount. Ooh. Where our DCF models suggest an intrinsic value closer to $350 or higher, a more aggressive, maybe debt finance buyback program would be massively accretive to EPS.
So what is that reluctant signal?
It reflects a profoundly risk-averse corporate culture. They're prioritizing immense liquidity and balance sheet stability over the full maximization of shareholder value through capital structure optimization.
Their M&A strategy, by contrast, has been pretty sensible. A series of strategic tuck-ins rather than these huge bet-the-company acquisitions.
Yes. They're focused on technology and market access. We saw the $40 million Mounts acquisition, which reinforced the C&I segment's high-precision focus, tying it directly to EV assembly.
We also saw the $200 million Dealer FX acquisition back in 2021, which brought them into the dealership service lane software market, complementing the Mitchell One data platform beautifully.
And the $36 million acquisition of AutoCrib in 2020 integrated them further into specialized inventory management for industrial customers. These are accretive, they're aligned with that coherent growth strategy, and they avoid the massive goodwill impairments that have plagued some of their larger, more aggressive peers.
But critically, they're too small to fundamentally shift the growth trajectory of a company that's already generating nearly $5 billion in revenue.
They're singles and doubles, not home runs.
It's time to address the existential threats. Let's start with the big one, the secular cliff. EVs, ADS, and the technician shortage. Let's challenge that simple bear case that fewer moving parts means fewer tools and Snap-on's revenue just collapses. We need the forensic rebuttal.
That simple bear case, the cool cliff, it's directionally accurate about the decline in traditional mechanical complexity.
Right, no oil changes, fewer transmission overhauls.
Less exhaust work. But it entirely misses the explosion in electronic complexity, software reliance, and the safety-critical replacement cycles that EVs and advanced driving systems demand.
Okay, so the volume decline in traditional mechanical tools, the wrenches and sockets, is offset by a necessary mix shift towards high-margin, specialized equipment. What specific infrastructure upgrades are mandatory for the EV era that Snap-on is uniquely positioned to address and profit from?
There are three non-discretionary categories. First, insulated tools. EVs operate high-voltage battery systems, typically 400V to 800V. Mechanics working on these systems must have tools rated for 1,000V to prevent instantaneous electrocution.
So the standard chrome vanadium wrench is now a massive liability.
It is. Snap-on sells these specialized, high-margin insulated tools, effectively creating a mandatory replacement cycle for basic hand tools in any shop that services modern vehicles.
Okay, what's number two?
Second is the sheer weight factor. Battery packs make EVs significantly heavier than their ICE predecessors, and this fundamentally changes the dynamics of the service bay. It requires heavier duty lifts, stronger suspension tools, specialized alignment equipment, and high-capacity tire changers.
So shops are forced to upgrade their fundamental infrastructure.
And Snap-on equipment benefits from this non-discretionary capital expenditure. It's mandated by basic safety and operational requirements.
And the third category.
And third, the highest margin mix shift of all, ADS calibration. Advanced driver assistance systems are now ubiquitous. Calibrating the radar, LiDAR, cameras, and sensors after even a minor collision requires highly specialized software, targets, and fixed stands.
And this is sophisticated, high-margin equipment that replaces the low-margin volume products, like simple oil filter wrenches.
And critically, these tools are often licensed. They fall under the RS&I segment, which converts a one-time equipment sale into a recurring revenue stream.
And the stabilizing factor here, the thing that gives Snap-on the time to execute this pivot, is the long tail of ICE. We can't forget that the average age of vehicles on the road has hit a record 12.8 years.
Those massive fleets of aging ICE vehicles, they are breaking. They're requiring complex, labor-intensive repair for decades to come. That massive, stable cash flow stream guarantees the funding required for Snap-on to execute its EV pivot without undue financial stress.
So the verdict here is that the tool cliff is not a precipice.
It's a slow, manageable, decades-long slope. The mix shift toward data, diagnostics, and high-tolerance safety tools should structurally offset the volume decline, assuming they maintain their leadership position.
Let's move to the technician demographics. This is a severe macro headwind that affects the total addressable market of the franchise channel. The U.S. shortage is chronic, with estimates of 37,000 to 70,000 unfilled positions annually.
The simple bear case is straightforward. Fewer total technicians means a shrinking customer base for the tool truck. This limits the total addressable market for personal tools purchased by individual mechanics. It puts pressure on the SOT segment.
But the bull case, it flips that scarcity on its head, and it actually benefits the RS&I segment.
How so?
Scarcity drives wage inflation. As technician wages rise, their disposable income increases, which is the money available for premium tools. They can afford the Snap-on premium.
And critically, scarcity also forces the hands of the shop owners. If they can't hire enough people, they must invest heavily in productivity-enhancing tools, automated equipment, advanced diagnostics to allow the few techs they have to handle a higher workload.
So it improves their throughput.
And this shifts spending from the individual mechanic, the traditional SOT customer, to the shop owner, who is the primary RS&I customer.
So the nuance here is critical.
Huh.
While the number of individual franchisee customers might stagnate, the average spend per customer is increasing, and the shop-level capital spend on RS&I solutions is accelerating.
Driven by the absolute necessity of productivity enhancement, that's precisely why the repair systems and information segment is showing 8.9% growth, while the tools segment is lagging.
Okay, to conclude this forensic interrogation, we have to place Snap-on within the competitive universe and determine if that valuation discount is actually justified. Let's look at the peer benchmark table and conduct a direct quality gap analysis.
When we compare Snap-on, S&A, directly to Illinois Tool Works, ITW, which is often considered the gold standard for high-quality, diversified industrials, a significant valuation gap appears. And this is despite both companies demonstrating similar high operational performance.
Let's just review the core metrics. Snap-on has a stellar operating margin, right? Hovering around 23 to 26%, which is comparable to ITW's 25 to 26%.
Exactly. And Snap-on's ROIC, which is exceptional at 17 to 22%, is still structurally very high, not far behind ITW's industry-leading 27%.
Yet Snap-on trades at a PE multiple of only about 18.2 times trailing earnings, while ITW trades significantly higher at 24.4 times. Why the gap?
This persistent discount, it's attributable to two main factors. First, ITW's broader diversification across multiple industrial sectors makes its revenue streams less cyclical. Second, and more importantly, the market's perceived franchise risk associated with the complexity and, frankly, the opacity of Snap-on's distribution channel applies a specific complexity discount.
And if we look at the other extreme, Stanley Black & Decker, which is recovering from its own issues, trading at 25.7x PE but generating a paltry 5% ROIC, it's clear Snap-on is fundamentally a superior, higher-quality business being conservatively valued.
I agree. And the real growth gap analysis is against the high-flying disruptors like Tektronix Industries, the parent of Milwaukee Tool. Snap-on is the mature incumbent, priced for slow growth. TTI trades as the high-growth disruptor and volume winner in the cordless revolution.
Snap-on can't compete on pure volume with TTI.
They cannot and should not attempt to. Their focus must remain on high-margin niche specialization and data.
Let's put some numbers on the current price using a robust discounted cash flow or DCF analysis. The stock is currently trading in the $340 to $350 range. What level of future performance does that price bake in?
It fundamentally assumes stagnation. A conservative DCF model assuming a 3% long-term growth rate, which simply matches their historical nominal growth and maintaining stable 25% operating margins, suggests an intrinsic value in the range of $360 to $380.
So the current trading price suggests the market is already baking in a mild degree of pessimism.
It's slightly underpricing even the stable muddle-through scenario.
Okay, let's run the scenario analysis to define the risk and reward clearly. What's the bear case?
The genuine tool cliff scenario. We assume 0% volume growth and competitive pressure erodes margins down to 20%. That scenario values the company around $260 to $280. But crucially, even in that bear case, the downside is protected by that fortress balance sheet. They have the cash.
That balance sheet provides an essential buffer.
It does. And then the bull case, the full SOS re-rating, assumes that RS&I growth successfully lifts the entire company to a 5% long-term growth rate, and RCI efforts push margins to 27%.
And in that scenario?
The intrinsic value shoots up to $450 plus shudder. The current valuation offers an asymmetric risk-reward profile. The downside is buffered by quality and capital structure, but the upside requires a successful execution of the data transition.
Which brings us to the sum of the parts argument. We've established that the consolidated valuation likely applies a complexity discount, obscuring the true value of the highest margin parts.
The captive finance arm and the software segment.
Right.
And that's the key investment thesis. If you could strip out repair systems and information, which is 31% of revenue and features high margins and recurring revenue, and value it like a typical high-quality SaaS business at, say, 15 to 20 times EBITDA.
Which is common for sticky data services.
Right. And then you value the remaining legacy tool segment like a standard mature industrial at maybe 8 to 10 times EBITDA, the combined intrinsic value would certainly exceed the current market cap. The conglomerate structure is clearly inhibiting a clean market valuation by blending the high multiple data business with the low multiple hardware business.
Okay, to bring this deep dive to a close, let's summarize our final verdict to the experienced, critical investor.
Snap-on Incorporated is fundamentally a high-quality hold, verging on a conservative buy. It is fundamentally suitable for patient capital seeking inflation protection and reliable income growth. The dividend is safe. It's growing 15 consecutive years of increases and currently yields about 2.8%.
So it's an excellent low-risk anchor in an income-focused portfolio.
Absolutely.
And the risk mitigation is sound. We confirm the company has a fortress balance sheet, low capital expenditure requirements, and minimal catastrophic loss risk due to its operational discipline. They are a deeply established essential services provider to critical industries.
And the core transition is not theoretical. It is underway. The company is actively evolving from a 20th century tool manufacturer into a 21st century vehicle uptime and data solutions company.
And the market is just not giving it full credit for this pivot yet.
It's not. It remains fixated on the rusting tool truck narrative and the threat from the cordless upstarts.
Let's dig into the strategic implications of that. You've established that Snap-on dominates a niche where price sensitivity is low because the customer's cost of failure downtime, broken equipment, is inherently high.
And this leads us to the final provocative thought for the critical investor to consider. Snap-on's historical pricing premium stemmed from the mechanic's psychological and operational fear of physical tool failure, a busted bolt, a missed torque spec.
Mm-hmm.
As the business shifts towards selling software and diagnostic data, can they maintain that premium when the failure risk shifts from a physical broken bolt to a software glitch, and when Chinese competitors are aggressively challenging the data and IP moat? That successful transition of pricing power from steel to code is the ultimate strategic question facing Snap-on's terminal value.